This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir. Translated by Constance Board and Sheila Malovany Chevalier. With an introduction by Judith Thurman. Read for you by Ellen Archer, with Judith Thurman reading her introduction. To Jacques Beaust. There is a good principle that created order, light, and man, and a bad principle that created chaos, darkness, and woman. Pythagoras. Everything that has been written by men about women should be viewed with suspicion, because they are both judge and party. Poulain de la Barre.
Hello, I'm Judith Thurman, and this is my introduction to The Second Sex. In 1946, Simone de Beauvoir began to outline what she thought would be an autobiographical essay, explaining why, when she had tried to define herself, the first sentence that came to mind was, "I am a woman." That October, my maiden aunt, Beauvoir's contemporary, came to visit me in the hospital nursery. I was a day old, and she found a little tag on my bassinet that announced, "It's a girl." In the next bassinet was another newborn, a lot punier, she recalled, whose little tag announced, "I'm a boy." There we lay, innocent of a distinction between a female object and a male subject that would shape our destinies. It would also shape Beauvoir's great treatise on the subject. Beauvoir was then a 38-year-old public intellectual who had been enfranchised for only a year. Legal birth control would be denied to French women until 1967, and legal abortion until 1975. Not until the late 1960s was there an elected female head of state anywhere in the world. Girls of my generation, searching for examples of exceptional women outside the ranks of queens and courtesans and of a few artists and saints, found precious few. The queens, as Beauvoir remarks, were neither male nor female, they were sovereigns. Opportunities for women have proliferated so broadly in the past six decades, at least in the Western world, that the distance between 2010 and 1949, when The Second Sex was published in France, seems like an eternity. Until, that is, one opens a newspaper, the victims of misogyny and sexual abuse are still with us everywhere. While no one individual or her work is responsible for that seismic shift in laws and attitudes, the millions of young women who now confidently assume that their entitlement to work, pleasure, and autonomy is equal to that of their brothers owe a measure of their freedom to Beauvoir. The Second Sex was an act of Promethean audacity, a theft of Olympian fire from which there was no turning back. It is not the last word on, quote, "the problem of woman," end quote, which Beauvoir wrote, quote, "has always been a problem of men," unquote, but it marks the place in history where an enlightenment begins. Simone Ernestine Lucie Marie Bertrand de Beauvoir was born in 1908 into a reactionary Catholic family with pretensions to nobility. She had a Proustian childhood on the Boulevard Montparnasse in Paris. But after World War I, her father, Georges, lost most of his fortune, and without dowries, Simone and her sister Hélène had dim prospects for a marriage within their class. Their mother, Françoise, a banker's daughter who had never lived without servants, did all the housework and sewing for the family. Her pious martyrdom indelibly impressed Simone, who would improve upon Virginia Woolf's famous advice and move to a room of her own in a hotel with maid service. Like Woolf and a striking number of other great women writers, note, Jane Austen, George Eliot, Emily Bronte, Charlotte Bronte, Emily Dickinson, Louisa May Alcott, Christina Rossetti, Lou Andrea Salomé, Gertrude Stein, Christina Stead, Isaac Dinesen, Catherine Mansfield, Edith Wharton, Simone Weil, Willa Cather, Carson McCullers, Anna de Noailles, Djuna Barnes, Marianne Moore, Hilda Doolittle, Marguerite Yourcenar, Sigrid Undset, Elsa Lasker-Schüle, Eudora Welty, Lillian Hellman, Monique Wittig, to name a few, Beauvoir was childless. And like Colette, who wasn't, she relegated her late-born only daughter to the care of surrogates, she regarded motherhood as a threat to her integrity. Colette is a ubiquitous presence in the second sex, which gives a new perspective to her boast in a memoir of 1946 that, quote, "My strain of virility saved me from the danger which threatens the writer, elevated to a happy and tender parent, of becoming a mediocre author. Beneath the still young woman that I was, an old boy of 40 saw to the well-being of a possibly precious part of myself." Madame de Beauvoir, intent on keeping up a facade of gentility, however shabby, sent her daughters to an elite convent school where Simone, for a while, ardently desired to become a nun, one of the few respectable vocations open to an ambitious girl. When she lost her faith as a teenager, her dreams of a transcendent union, dreams that proved remarkably tenacious, shifted from Christ to an enchanting classmate named Zaza, and to a rich, indolent first cousin and childhood playmate, Jacques, who took her slumming and gave her a taste for alcohol and for louche nightlife that she never outgrew. Not many bookish virgins with a particle in their surname got drunk with the hookers and drug addicts at Lustix. Her mother hoped vainly that the worthless Jacques would propose. Her father, a ladies' man, knew better. He told his temperamental, ill-dressed, pimply genius of a daughter that she would never marry. But by then, Simone de Beauvoir had seen what a woman of almost any quality, high-born or low, pure or impure, contented with her lot or alienated, could expect from a man's world. Beauvoir's singular brilliance was apparent from a young age to her teachers and to herself. An insatiable curiosity and a prodigious capacity for synthetic reading and analysis, a more inspired grind may never have existed, nourished her drive. One of her boyfriends dubbed her Castor, the Beaver, a nickname that stuck. She had a sense of inferiority, it would appear, only in relation to Jean-Paul Sartre. They met in 1929 as university students, she a star at the Sorbonne, he at the École Normale Supérieure, cramming as a team for France's most brutal and competitive postgraduate examination, the Agrégation in Philosophy. On their first study date, she explained Leibniz to him. Success would qualify her for a lifetime sinecure teaching at a lycée and liberate her from her family. When the results were posted, Sartre was first and Beauvoir second. She was the ninth woman who had ever passed. And that forever was the order of precedence, Adam before Eve, in their creation myth as a couple. Even though their ideal was of a love without domination, it was part of the myth that Sartre was Beauvoir's first man. After Georges de Beauvoir confronted them about their more or less open sexual liaison, Sartre, the more bourgeois, proposed marriage, and Beauvoir told him, quote, "not to be silly," end quote. She had emerged from her age of awkwardness as a severe beauty with high cheekbones and a regal forehead who wore her dark hair plaited and rolled, an old-fashioned duenna's coif rather piquantly at odds with her appetites and behavior. Both sexes attracted her, and Sartre was never the most compelling of her lovers, but they recognized that each possessed something uniquely necessary to the other. As he put it one afternoon walking in the Tuileries, "You and I are as one, on ne fait qu'un." He categorized their union as an essential love that only death could sunder, although in time, he said, they would naturally both have contingent loves, freely enjoyed and fraternally confessed in a spirit of authenticity. She often recruited and shared his girls, some of whom were her students, and her first novel, She Came to Stay, in 1943, was based on one of their ménages à trois. At every level, Beauvoir reflected years later, of the pain she had suffered and inflicted, Quote, we failed to face the weight of reality, priding ourselves on what we called our radical freedom, end quote. But they also failed to fault themselves for the contingent casualties, the inessential others who were sacrificed to their experiment. And the burden of free love, Beauvoir would discover, was grossly unequal for a woman and for a man. If Beauvoir has proved to be an irresistible subject for biographers, it is in part because she and Sartre, as a pharaonic couple of incestuous deities, reigned over 20th century French intellectual life in the decades of its greatest ferment. But the most fascinating subjects tend to be those richest in contradictions, and the second sex, no less than Beauvoir's prolific and important fiction, memoirs, and correspondence, seethes with them. Deirdre Baer, Beauvoir's biographer, touches upon a fundamental paradox in the introduction to her admirable life. She and Sartre's biographer, Annie Cohen-Solal, had been lecturing together at Harvard. At the conclusion of their talk, she writes, quote, I could not help but comment to my distinguished audience that every question asked about Sartre concerned his work, while all those asked about Beauvoir concerned her personal life, end quote. Yet Sartre's work, and specifically the existentialist notion of an opposition between a sovereign self, a subject, and an objectified other, gave Beauvoir the conceptual scaffold for the second sex, while her life as a woman, indeed as Sartre's woman, impelled her to write it. He had once told her that she had a man's intelligence, and there is no evidence that he changed his mind about a patronizing slight that she too accepted as a compliment until she began to consider what it implied. It implied, she would write, that humanity is male, and man defines woman, not in herself but in relation to himself. And by all the qualities Colette's strain of virility, she is presumed to lack. Her twinship with Sartre was an illusion. Note, Sartre's work has been credited by Beauvoir and others for having given her the scaffold, although a journal from her university years, which was discovered after her death by her companion and adopted daughter, Sylvie Lebon de Beauvoir, suggests that Beauvoir had arrived at the notion of a fundamental conflict between self and other before she met Sartre, partly through her reading of Henri Bergson, but partly through her own struggle, an explicit and implicit subtext of the second sex, with an imperious need for love that she experienced as a temptation to self-abnegation. The second sex has been called a feminist Bible, an epithet bound to discourage impious readers wary of a sacred text and a personality cult. Beauvoir herself was as devout an atheist as she had once been a Catholic, and she dismisses religions, even when they worship a goddess, as the inventions of men to perpetuate their dominion. The analogy is fitting, though, and not only to the grandeur of a book that was the first of its kind, but also to its structure. Beauvoir begins her narrative, like the author of Genesis, with the fall into knowledge. The two volumes that elaborate on the consequences of that fall are the Old and New Testaments of an unchosen people with a history of enslavement. Facts and Myths is a chronicle of womankind from prehistory to the 1940s. Lived Experience is a minutely detailed case study of contemporary womanhood and its stations of the cross, from girlhood through puberty and sexual initiation to maturity and old age, with detours from the well-trodden road to Calvary taken by mystics and lesbians. The epic concludes, like Revelation, with an eloquent, if utopian, vision of redemption. The same drama of flesh and spirit, and of finitude and transcendence, plays itself out in both sexes. Both are eaten away by time, stalked by death. They have the same essential need of the other, and they can take the same glory from their freedom. If they knew how to savor it, they would no longer be tempted to contend for false privileges, and fraternity could then be born between them. The first English edition of The Second Sex was published in 1953. Blanche Knopf, the wife of Alfred Knopf, Beauvoir's American publisher, had heard of the book on a scouting trip to Paris. Thinking that this sensational literary property was a highbrow sex manual, she had asked an academic who knew about the birds and the bees, H.M. Poshley, a retired professor of zoology at Smith College, for a reader's report. His enthusiasm for the work, intelligent, learned, and well-balanced, not feminist in any doctrinaire sense, won him the commission to translate it. But Alfred Knopf asked Poshley to condense the text, noting without undue masculine gallantry that Beauvoir, quote, certainly suffers from verbal diarrhea. Poshley appealed to the author for advice on the, quote, minor cuts and abridgments that Knopf felt were essential for the American market. She was either too busy or unwilling to reply because he heard nothing until he received an indignant letter protesting that, quote, so much of what seems important to me will have been omitted, end quote. But she signed off graciously on the edition. While the translation was a labor of love, from which Poshley nearly expired, he lacked a background in philosophy or in French literature. He also lacked a credential more pertinent, perhaps, to the audience for a foundational work of modern feminism, A Second X Chromosome. This eagerly awaited new translation, by Constance Board and Sheila Malovny Chevalier, the first since Poshley's, is a magisterial exercise in fidelity. The cuts have been restored, and the English is as lucid and elegant as Beauvoir's ambition to be exhaustive permits it to be. She is a bold, sagacious, often dazzling writer and a master aphorist, but no one would accuse her of being a lapidary stylist. It is hard to find a description for the prose that does justice both to its incisive power and to its manic garrulity. Elizabeth Hardwick came closest, perhaps, when she called The Second Sex, quote, madly sensible and brilliantly confused. Note. Examples of Beauvoir's aphorisms are numerous. They include, the cult of the virgin is the rehabilitation of woman by the achievement of her defeat. The average Western male's ideal is a woman who intelligently resists but yields in the end. The traditional woman tries to conceal her dependence from herself, which is a way of consenting to it. The stamina that it takes to read The Second Sex in its entirety pales before the feat of writing it. Sartre was happy when his beaver was busy, Beauvoir told Baer, because I was no bother to him. One is humbled to learn that this 800-page encyclopedia of the folklore, customs, laws, history, religion, philosophy, anthropology, literature, economic systems, and received ideas that have, since time began, objectified women, was researched and composed in about 14 months between 1946 and 1949, while Beauvoir was also engaged with other literary projects, traveling widely, editing and contributing to Les Temps Modernes, Sartre's leftist political review, and juggling her commitments to him and the family, their entourage of friends, groupies, disciples, and lovers, with a wild transatlantic love affair. On a trip to America in 1947, she had met the novelist Nelson Algren, the most significant of her male others, and it was he who advised her to expand the essay on women into a book. He had shown her the underside of his native Chicago, and that year and the next they explored the United States and Mexico together. Her encounter with the racism that she had never witnessed firsthand, and her friendship with Richard Wright, the author of Native Son, helped to clarify her understanding of sexism and its relation to the anti-Semitism that she certainly had witnessed firsthand before and during the war, but with Sartre had never openly challenged. The black, the Jew, and the woman, she concluded, were objectified as the other, in ways that were both overtly despotic and insidious, but with the same result. Their particularity as human beings was reduced to a lazy, abstract cliché. The eternal feminine, the black soul, the Jewish character, that served as a rationale for their subjugation. Note, in the course of her research, Beauvoir audited classes by Lacan and Levi-Strauss, among others. She did interviews with women of all backgrounds on two continents, and she spent endless days in reference libraries and in lecture halls. Not all of Beauvoir's staggering erudition and Mandarin authority in The Second Sex is reliable. She would repudiate a number of her more contentious or blinkered generalities, though not all of them. Her single most famous assertion, "one is not born, but rather becomes woman," has been disputed by more recent feminist scholars, and a substantial body of research in biology and the social sciences supports their argument that some sexual differences, besides the obvious ones, are innate rather than situational. Instead of rejecting otherness as an imposed cultural construct, women, in their opinion, should cultivate it as a source of self-knowledge and expression, and use it as the basis to critique patriarchal institutions. Many readers have also been alienated by Beauvoir's visceral horror of fertility, the, quote, curse of reproduction, and her desire, as they see it, to homogenize the human race. Yet a revolution cannot begin until the diffuse, private indignation of individuals coalesces into a common cause. Beauvoir not only marshaled a vast arsenal of fact and theory, she galvanized a critical mass of consciousness, a collective identity that was indispensable to the women's movement. Her insights have breached the solitude of countless readers around the world who thought that the fears, transgressions, fantasies, and desires that fed their ambivalence about being female were aberrant or unique. No woman before her had written publicly, with greater candor and less euphemism, about the most intimate secrets of her sex. One of those secrets, the hardest perhaps for Beauvoir to avow, is that a free woman may refuse to be owned without wanting to renounce or being able to transcend her yearning to be possessed. Note, it was a source of her bad faith in fictionalizing the affair with Algren in her finest novel, The Mandarins. As long as the temptations of facility remain, she wrote, by which she meant the temptations of romantic love, social prestige, and a sense of purpose derived from a man, all of which Sartre had at one time or another provided for her, a woman, quote, needs to expend a greater moral effort than the male to choose the path of independence. Colette, who would have smiled, and not kindly, at the phrase moral effort, states the problem less cerebrally. How to liberate my true hope? Everything is against me. The first obstacle to my escape is this woman's body barring my way, a voluptuous body with closed eyes, voluntarily blind, stretched out full, ready to perish. To a reader of this new translation, a young feminist perhaps, for whom the very title may seem as quaint as a pair of bloomers, I would suggest that the best way to appreciate The Second Sex is to read it in the spirit it was written, as a deep and urgent personal meditation on a true hope that, as she will probably discover, is still elusive for many of us, to become, in every sense, one's own woman.
Translator's note. We have spent the past 3 years researching Le Deuxième Sexe and translating it into English, into The Second Sexe. It has been a daunting task and a splendid learning experience during which this monumental work entered our personal lives and changed the way we see the world. Questions naturally arose about the act of translating itself, about ourselves and our roles, and about our responsibilities to both Simone de Beauvoir and her readers. Translation has always been fraught with such questions, and different times have produced different conceptions of translating. Perhaps this is why, while great works of art seldom age, translations do. The job of the translator is not to simplify or readapt the text for a modern or foreign audience, but to find the true voice of the original work as it was written for its time and with its original intent. Seeking signification in another's words transports the translator into the mind of the writer. When the text is an opus like The Second Sex, whose impact on society was so decisive, the task of bringing into English the closest version possible of Simone de Beauvoir's voice, expression, and mind is greater still. This is not the first translation of Le Deuxième Sexe into English, but it is the first complete one. H.M. Parsley translated it in 1953, but he abridged and edited passages and simplified some of the complex philosophical language. We have translated Le Deuxième Sexe as it was written, unabridged and unsimplified, maintaining Beauvoir's philosophical language. The long and dense paragraphs that were changed in the 1953 translation to conform to more traditional styles of punctuation, or even eliminated, have now been translated as she wrote them, all within the confines of English. Long paragraphs, sometimes going on for pages, are a stylistic aspect of her writing that is essential, integral to the development of her arguments. Cutting her sentences, cutting her paragraphs, and using a more traditional and conventional punctuation do not render Simone de Beauvoir's voice. Beauvoir's style expresses her reasoning. Her prose has its own consistent grammar, and that grammar follows a logic. We did not modernize the language Beauvoir used and had access to in 1949. This decision precluded the use of the word gender, for example, as applied today. We also stayed close to Beauvoir's complicated syntax and punctuation, as well as to certain usages of language that, to us, felt a bit awkward at first. One of the difficulties was her extensive use of the semicolon, a punctuation mark that has suffered setbacks over the past decades in English and French, and has somewhat fallen into disuse. Nor did we modernize structures such as, if the subject attempts to assert himself, the other is nonetheless necessary for him. Today, we would say, if the subject attempts to assert her or himself. There are examples where the word individual clearly refers to a woman, but Beauvoir, because of French rules of grammar, uses the masculine pronoun. We therefore do the same in English. While we were tempted to standardize it, we carried Beauvoir's style and formatting into English as much as possible. In addition, we used the same chapter headings and numbers that she did in the original two-volume Gallimard edition. We also made the decision to keep close to Beauvoir's tense usage, most noticeably regarding the French use of the present tense for the historical past. One particularly complex and compelling issue was how to translate la femme. In Le Deuxième Sexe, the term has at least two meanings, the woman and woman. At times, it can also mean women, depending on the context. Woman in English used alone without an article captures woman as an institution, a concept, femininity as determined and defined by society, culture, history. Thus, in a French sentence such as Le problème de la femme a toujours été un problème d'homme, we have used woman without an article. The problem of woman has always been a problem of men. Beauvoir occasionally, but rarely, uses femme without an article to signify woman as determined by society, as just described. In such cases, of course, we do the same. The famous sentence, on ne n'est pas femme, on le devient, reads in our translation, one is not born, but rather becomes woman. The original translation by H.M. Parsley read, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. Another notable change we made was in the translation of La Jeune Fille. This is the title of an important chapter in Volume 2 dealing with the period in a female's life between childhood and adulthood. While it is often translated as The Young Girl by Parsley and other translators of French works, we think it clearly means girl. We have included all of Beauvoir's footnotes, and we have added notes of our own when we felt an explanation was necessary. Among other things, they indicate errors in Beauvoir's text and discrepancies such as erroneous dates. We corrected misspellings of names without noting them. Beauvoir sometimes puts into quotes passages that she is partially or completely paraphrasing. We generally left them that way. The listener will notice that titles of the French books she cites are given in French, followed by their translation in English. We did not, however, facilitate the listening by explaining arcane references or difficult philosophical language. As an example of the former, in Part 3 of Volume 2, Justifications, there is a reference to Cécile Sorel breaking the glass of a picture frame holding a caricature of her by an artist named Beeb. The reference might have been as obscure in 1949 as it is today. These are but a few of the issues we dealt with. We had instructive discussions with generous experts about these points and listened to many, sometimes contradictory, opinions. But in the end, the final decisions as to how to treat the translation were ours. It is generally agreed that one of the most serious absences in the first translation was Simone de Beauvoir, the philosopher. Much work has been done on reclaiming, valorizing, and expanding upon her role as philosopher since the 1953 publication, thanks to the scholarship of Margaret Simons, Eva Lundgren-Gotlin, Michel Leduf, Elizabeth Falaise, Emily Grossholtz, Sonia Crux, and Ingrid Galster, to mention only a few. We were keenly aware of the need to put the philosopher back into her text. To transpose her philosophical style and voice into English was the most crucial task we faced. The first English language translation did not always recognize the philosophical terminology in The Second Sex. Take the crucial word authentic, meaning to be in good faith. As Toril Moy points out, partially changed it into real, genuine, and true. The distinctive existentialist term pour soi, usually translated as for itself, pour soi referring to human consciousness, became her true nature in itself. Thus, Parsley's being in itself, en soi, lacking human consciousness, is a reversal of Simone de Beauvoir's meaning. Margaret Simons and Toril Moy have unearthed and brought to light many other examples, such as the use of alienation, alterity, subject, and the verb to posit, which are by now well documented. One particularly striking example is the title of Volume 2, L'Expérience Vécue, Lived Experience, was translated as Woman's Life Today, weakening the philosophical tenor of the French. The Second Sex is a philosophical treatise and one of the most important books of the 20th century, upon which much of the modern feminist movement was built. Beauvoir the philosopher is present right from the start of the book, building on the ideas of Hegel, Marx, Kant, Heidegger, Husserl, and others. She developed, shared, and appropriated these concepts alongside her equally brilliant contemporaries, Sartre, Merleau-Ponty, and Levi-Strauss, who were redefining philosophy to fit the times. Before it was published, Beauvoir read Levi-Strauss's Elementary Structures of Kinship and learned from and used those ideas in The Second Sex. Although the ideas and concepts are challenging, the book was immediately accepted by a general readership. Our goal in this translation has been to conform to the same ideal in English, to say what Simone de Beauvoir said as close to the way she said it, in a text both readable and challenging. Throughout our work, we were given the most generous help from the many experts we consulted. In every area Simone de Beauvoir delved into, whether in psychoanalysis, biology, anthropology, or philosophy, they helped us to produce the most authentic English version of her work. And now it is for English listeners to discover, learn, and live Simone de Beauvoir's message of freedom and independence. Volume 1. Facts and Myths. Introduction. I hesitated a long time before writing a book on woman. The subject is irritating, especially for women, and it is not new. Enough ink has flowed over the quarrel about feminism. It is now almost over. Let's not talk about it anymore. Yet it is still being talked about. And the volumes of idiocies churned out over this past century do not seem to have clarified the problem. Besides, is there a problem? And what is it? Are there even women? True, the theory of the eternal feminine still has its followers. They whisper, even in Russia, women are still very much women. But other well-informed people, and also at times those same ones, lament, woman is losing herself, woman is lost. It is hard to know any longer if women still exist, if they will always exist, if there should be women at all, what place they hold in this world, what place they should hold. Where are the women? Asked a short-lived magazine recently. Note, out of print today, titled Franchise. But first, what is a woman? Tota mulier in utero. She is a womb, some say. Yet, speaking of certain women, the experts proclaim, they are not women, even though they have a uterus like the others. Everyone agrees there are females in the human species. Today, as in the past, they make up about half of humanity, and yet we are told that femininity is in jeopardy. We are urged, be women, stay women, become women. So not every female human being is necessarily a woman. She must take part in this mysterious and endangered reality known as femininity. Is femininity secreted by the ovaries? Is it enshrined in a platonic heaven? Is a frilly petticoat enough to bring it down to earth? Although some women zealously strive to embody it, the model has never been patented. It is typically described in vague and shimmering terms borrowed from a clairvoyant's vocabulary. In St. Thomas's time, it was an essence defined with as much certainty as the sedative quality of a poppy. But conceptualism has lost ground. Biological and social sciences no longer believe there are immutably determined entities that define given characteristics like those of the woman, the Jew, or the black. Science considers characteristics as secondary reactions to a situation. If there is no such thing today as femininity, it is because there never was. Does the word woman, then, have no content? It is what advocates of Enlightenment philosophy, rationalism, or nominalism vigorously assert. Women are, among human beings, merely those who are arbitrarily designated by the word woman. American women in particular are inclined to think that woman, as such, no longer exists. If some backward individual still takes herself for a woman, her friends advise her to undergo psychoanalysis to get rid of this obsession. Referring to a book, a very irritating one at that, Modern Woman, The Lost Sex, Dorothy Parker wrote, I cannot be fair about books that treat women as women. My idea is that all of us, men as well as women, whoever we are, should be considered as human beings. But nominalism is a doctrine that falls a bit short, and it is easy for anti-feminists to show that women are not men. Certainly, woman, like man, is a human being, but such an assertion is abstract. The fact is that every concrete human being is always uniquely situated. To reject the notions of the eternal feminine, the black soul, or the Jewish character is not to deny that there are today Jews, blacks, or women. This denial is not a liberation for those concerned, but an inauthentic flight. Clearly, no woman can claim without bad faith to be situated beyond her sex. A few years ago, a well-known woman writer refused to have her portrait appear in a series of photographs devoted specifically to women writers. She wanted to be included in the men's category. But to get this privilege, she used her husband's influence. Women who assert they are men still claim masculine consideration and respect. I also remember a young Trotskyite standing on a platform during a stormy meeting, about to come to blows in spite of her obvious fragility. She was denying her feminine frailty, but it was for the love of a militant man she wanted to be equal to. The defiant position that American women occupy proves they are haunted by the sentiment of their own femininity. And the truth is that anyone can clearly see that humanity is split into two categories of individuals with manifestly different clothes, faces, bodies, smiles, movements, interests, and occupations. These differences are perhaps superficial. Perhaps they are destined to disappear. What is certain is that for the moment, they exist in a strikingly obvious way. If the female function is not enough to define woman, and if we also reject the explanation of the eternal feminine, but if we accept, even temporarily, that there are women on the earth, we then have to ask, what is a woman? Merely stating the problem suggests an immediate answer to me. It is significant that I pose it. It would never occur to a man to write a book on the singular situation of males in humanity. Note, the Kinsey Report, for example, confines itself to defining the sexual characteristics of the American man, which is completely different. If I want to define myself, I first have to say, I am a woman. All other assertions will arise from this basic truth. A man never begins by positing himself as an individual of a certain sex. That he is a man is obvious. The categories masculine and feminine appear as symmetrical in a formal way on town hall records or identification papers. The relation of the two sexes is not that of two electrical poles. The man represents both the positive and the neuter to such an extent that in French, homme designates human beings, the particular meaning of the word vir being assimilated into the general meaning of the word homo. Woman is the negative, to such a point that any determination is imputed to her as a limitation, without reciprocity. I used to get annoyed in abstract discussions to hear men tell me, you think such and such a thing because you're a woman. But I know my only defense is to answer, I think it because it is true, thereby eliminating my subjectivity. It was out of the question to answer, and you think the contrary because you are a man. Because it is understood that being a man is not a particularity. A man is in his right by virtue of being man. It is the woman who was in the wrong. In fact, just as for the ancients, there was an absolute vertical that defined the oblique, there is an absolute human type that is masculine. Woman has ovaries and a uterus. Such are the particular conditions that lock her in her subjectivity. Some even say she thinks with her hormones. Man vainly forgets that his anatomy also includes hormones and testicles. He grasps his body as a direct and normal link with the world that he believes he apprehends in all objectivity, whereas he considers woman's body an obstacle, a prison, burdened by everything that particularizes it. The female is female by virtue of a certain lack of qualities, Aristotle said. We should regard women's nature as suffering from natural defectiveness. And St. Thomas, in his turn, decreed that woman was an incomplete man, an incidental being. This is what the Genesis story symbolizes, where Eve appears as if drawn from Adam's supernumerary bone, in Bossuet's words. Humanity is male, and man defines woman, not in herself, but in relation to himself. She is not considered an autonomous being. Woman, the relative being, writes Michelet. Thus, Monsieur Bondat declares in Le Rapport d'Uriel, Uriel's report, A man's body has meaning by itself, disregarding the body of the woman, whereas the woman's body seems devoid of meaning without reference to the male. Man thinks himself without woman. Woman does not think herself without man. And she is nothing other than what man decides. She is thus called the sex, meaning that the male sees her essentially as a sexed being. For him, she is sex, so she is it in the absolute. She is determined and differentiated in relation to man, while he is not in relation to her. She is the inessential in front of the essential. He is the subject. He is the absolute. She is the other. Note, this idea has been expressed in its most explicit form by E. Levinas in his essay Le Temps et l'Autre, Time and the Other. He expresses it like this. Is there not a situation where alterity would be born by a being in a positive sense, as essence? What is the alterity that does not purely and simply enter into the opposition of two species of the same genus? I think that the absolutely contrary contrary, whose contrariety is in no way affected by the relationship that can be established between it and its correlative, the contrariety that permits its terms to remain absolutely other, is the feminine. Sex is not some specific difference. Neither is the difference between the sexes a contradiction. Neither is the difference between the sexes the duality of two complementary terms. For two complementary terms presuppose a pre-existing whole. Alterity is accomplished in the feminine. The term is on the same level as, but in meaning opposed to, consciousness. I suppose Mr. Levinas is not forgetting that woman also is consciousness for herself. But it is striking that he deliberately adopts a man's point of view, disregarding the reciprocity of the subject and the object. When he writes that woman is mystery, he assumes that she is mystery for man. So this apparently objective description is in fact an affirmation of masculine privilege. The category of other is as original as consciousness itself. The duality between self and other can be found in the most primitive societies, in the most ancient mythologies. This division did not always fall into the category of the division of the sexes. It was not based on any empirical given. This comes out in works like Granet's on Chinese thought and Dumézil's on India and Rome. In couples such as Varuna Mitra, Uranus Zeus, Sun Moon, Day Night, no feminine element is involved at the outset. Neither is good evil. Auspicious and inauspicious, left and right, God and Lucifer. Alterity is the fundamental category of human thought. No group ever defines itself as one without immediately setting up the other opposite itself. It only takes three travelers brought together by chance in the same train compartment for the rest of the travelers to become vaguely hostile others. Village people view anyone not belonging to the village as suspicious others. For the native of a country, inhabitants of other countries are viewed as foreigners. Jews are the others for anti-Semites, blacks for racist Americans, indigenous people for colonists, proletarians for the propertied classes. After studying the diverse forms of primitive society in depth, Levi Strauss could conclude, "The passage from the state of nature to the state of culture is defined by man's ability to think biological relations as systems of oppositions, duality, alternation, opposition, and symmetry, whether occurring in defined or less clear form, are not so much phenomena to explain as fundamental and immediate givens of social reality." Note, see Claude Lévi-Strauss, Les structures élémentaires de la parenté, The Elementary Structures of Kinship. I thank Claude Lévi-Strauss for sharing the proofs of his thesis, which I drew on heavily, particularly in the second part. These phenomena could not be understood if human reality were solely a mitzvah based on solidarity and friendship. Note, mitzvah can be translated as being with. The French term réalité humaine, human reality, has been problematically used to translate Heidegger's Dasein. Translation. On the contrary, they become clear if, following Hegel, a fundamental hostility to any other consciousness is found in consciousness itself. The subject posits itself only in opposition. It asserts itself as the essential and sets up the other as inessential, as the object. But the other consciousness has an opposing reciprocal claim. Traveling, a local is shocked to realize that in neighboring countries, locals view him as a foreigner. Between villages, clans, nations, and classes, there are wars, potlatches, agreements, treaties, and struggles that remove the absolute meaning from the idea of the other and bring out its relativity. Whether one likes it or not, individuals and groups have no choice but to recognize the reciprocity of their relation. How is it, then, that between the sexes this reciprocity has not been put forward, that one of the terms has been asserted as the only essential one, denying any relativity in regard to its correlative, defining the latter as pure alterity? Why do women not contest male sovereignty? No subject posits itself spontaneously and at once as the inessential from the outset. It is not the other who, defining itself as other, defines the one. The other is posited as other by the one positing itself as one. But in order for the other not to turn into the one, the other has to submit to this foreign point of view. Where does this submission in woman come from? There are other cases where, for a shorter or longer time, one category has managed to dominate another, absolutely. It is often numerical inequality that confers this privilege. The majority imposes its law on or persecutes the minority. But women are not a minority like American blacks or like Jews. There are as many women as men on the earth. Often, the two opposing groups concerned were once independent of each other. Either they were not aware of each other in the past, or they accepted each other's autonomy. And some historical events subordinated the weaker to the stronger. The Jewish diaspora, slavery in America, and the colonial conquests are facts with dates. In these cases, for the oppressed, there was a before. They share a past, a tradition, sometimes a religion or a culture. In this sense, the parallel Babel draws between women and the proletariat would be the best founded. Proletarians are not a numerical minority either, and yet they have never formed a separate group. However, not one event, but a whole historical development explains their existence as a class and accounts for the distribution of these individuals in this class. There have not always been proletarians. There have always been women. They are women by their physiological structure. As far back as history can be traced, they have always been subordinate to men. Their dependence is not the consequence of an event or a becoming. It did not happen. Alterity here appears to be an absolute, partly because it falls outside the accidental nature of historical fact. A situation created over time can come undone at another time. Blacks in Haiti, for one, are a good example. On the contrary, a natural condition seems to defy change. In truth, nature is no more an immutable given than is historical reality. If woman discovers herself as the inessential and never turns into the essential, it is because she does not bring about this transformation herself. Proletarians say we, so do blacks. Positing themselves as subjects, they thus transform the bourgeois or whites into others. Women, except in certain abstract gatherings such as conferences, do not use we. Men say women, and women adopt this word to refer to themselves, but they do not posit themselves authentically as subjects. The proletarians made the revolution in Russia. The blacks in Haiti, the Indochinese are fighting in Indochina. Women's actions have never been more than symbolic agitation. They have won only what men have been willing to concede to them. They have taken nothing. They have received. Note, refer to second part. It is that they lack the concrete means to organize themselves into a unit that could posit itself in opposition. They have no past, no history, no religion of their own. And unlike the proletariat, they have no solidarity of labor or interests. They even lack their own space that makes communities of American blacks, the Jews in ghettos, or the workers in Saint-Denis or Renault factories. They live dispersed among men, tied by homes, work, economic interests, and social conditions to certain men, fathers or husbands, more closely than to other women. As bourgeois women, they are in solidarity with bourgeois men and not with women proletarians. As white women, they are in solidarity with white men and not with black women. The proletariat could plan to massacre the whole ruling class. A fanatic Jew or black could dream of seizing the secret of the atomic bomb and turning all of humanity entirely Jewish or entirely black. But a woman could not even dream of exterminating males. The tie that binds her to her oppressors is unlike any other. The division of the sexes is a biological given, not a moment in human history. Their opposition took shape within an original Mitzvah, and she has not broken it. The couple is a fundamental unit with the two halves riveted to each other. Cleavage of society by sex is not possible. This is the fundamental characteristic of woman. She is the other at the heart of a whole whose two components are necessary to each other. One might think that this reciprocity would have facilitated her liberation. When Hercules spins wool at Omphale's feet, his desire enchains him. Why was Omphale unable to acquire long-lasting power? Medea, in revenge against Jason, kills her children. This brutal legend suggests that the bond attaching the woman to her child could have given her a formidable upper hand. In Lysistrata, Aristophanes lightheartedly imagined a group of women who, uniting together for the social good, tried to take advantage of men's need for them, but it is only a comedy. The legend that claims that the ravish Sabine women resisted their ravishers with obstinate sterility also recounts that by whipping them with leather straps, the men magically won them over into submission. Biological need, sexual desire, and desire for posterity, which makes the male dependent on the female, has not liberated women socially. Master and slave are also linked by a reciprocal economic need that does not free the slave. That is, in the master-slave relation, the master does not posit the need he has for the other. He holds the power to satisfy this need and does not mediate it. The slave, on the other hand, out of dependence, hope, or fear, internalizes his need for the master, however equally compelling the need may be to them both. It always plays in favor of the oppressor over the oppressed. This explains the slow pace of working class liberation, for example. Now, woman has always been, if not man's slave, at least his vassal. The two sexes have never divided the world up equally. And still today, even though her condition is changing, woman is heavily handicapped. In no country is her legal status identical to man's, and often it puts her at a considerable disadvantage. Even when her rights are recognized abstractly, long-standing habit keeps them from being concretely manifested in customs. Economically, men and women almost form two castes. All things being equal, the former have better jobs, higher wages, and greater chances to succeed than their new female competitors. They occupy many more places in industry, in politics, and so forth, and they hold the most important positions. In addition to their concrete power, they are invested with a prestige whose tradition is reinforced by the child's whole education. The present incorporates the past, and in the past, all history was made by males. At the moment that women are beginning to share in the making of the world, this world still belongs to men. Men have no doubt about this, and women barely doubt it. Refusing to be the other, refusing complicity with man, would mean renouncing all the advantages an alliance with a superior caste confers on them. Lord Man will materially protect liege woman and will be in charge of justifying her existence. Along with the economic risk, she eludes the metaphysical risk of a freedom that must invent its goals without help. Indeed, beside every individual's claim to assert himself as subject, an ethical claim, lies the temptation to flee freedom and to make himself into a thing. It is a pernicious path because the individual, passive, alienated, and lost, is prey to a foreign will, cut off from his transcendence, robbed of all worth. But it is an easy path. The anguish and stress of authentically assumed existence are thus avoided. The man who sets the woman up as an other will thus find in her a deep complicity. Hence, woman makes no claim for herself as subject because she lacks the concrete means, because she senses the necessary link connecting her to man without positing its reciprocity, and because she often derives satisfaction from her role as other. But a question immediately arises. How did this whole story begin? It is understandable that the duality of the sexes, like all duality, be expressed in conflict. It is understandable that if one of the two succeeded in imposing its superiority, it had to establish itself as absolute. It remains to be explained how it was that man won at the outset. It seems possible that women might have carried off the victory, or that the battle might never be resolved. Why is it that this world has always belonged to men, and that only today things are beginning to change? Is this change a good thing? Will it bring about an equal sharing of the world between men and women, or not? These questions are far from new. They have already had many answers. But the very fact that woman is other challenges all the justifications that men have ever given. These were only too clearly dictated by their own interest. Everything that men have written about women should be viewed with suspicion because they are both judge and party, wrote Poulain de la Barre, a little-known 17th century feminist. Males have always and everywhere paraded their satisfaction of feeling they are kings of creation. Blessed be the Lord our God, and the Lord of all worlds that has not made me a woman, Jews say in their morning prayers. Meanwhile, their wives resignedly murmur, Blessed be the Lord for creating me according to his will. Among the blessings Plato thanked the gods for was, first, being born free and not a slave, and second, a man and not a woman. But males could not have enjoyed this privilege so fully had they not considered it as founded in the absolute and in eternity. They sought to make the fact of their supremacy a right. Those who made and compiled the laws, being men, favored their own sex, and the jurisconsults have turned the laws into principles. Poulain de la Barre continues. Lawmakers, priests, philosophers, writers, and scholars have gone to great lengths to prove that women's subordinate condition was willed in heaven and profitable on earth. Religions forged by men reflect this will for domination. They found ammunition in the legends of Eve and Pandora. They have put philosophy and theology in their service, as heard in the previously cited words of Aristotle and St. Thomas. Since ancient times, satirists and moralists have delighted in depicting women's weaknesses. The violent indictments brought against them all through French literature are well known. Montherlant, with less verve, picks up the tradition from Jean de Meung. This hostility seems sometimes founded, but is often gratuitous. In truth, it covers up a more or less skillfully camouflaged will to self-justification. It is much easier to accuse one sex than to excuse the other, says Montaigne. In certain cases, the process is transparent. It is striking, for example, that the Roman code limiting a wife's rights invokes the imbecility and fragility of the sex, just when a weakening family structure makes her a threat to male heirs. It is striking that in the 16th century, to keep a married woman under wardship, the authority of St. Augustine affirming the wife is an animal neither reliable nor stable is called on, whereas the unmarried woman is recognized as capable of managing her own affairs. Montaigne well understood the arbitrariness and injustice of the lot assigned to women. Women are not wrong at all when they reject the rules of life that have been introduced into the world, inasmuch as it is the men who have made these without them. There is a natural plotting and scheming between them and us. But he does not go so far as to champion their cause. It is only in the 18th century that deeply democratic men begin to consider the issue objectively. Diderot, for one, tries to prove that, like man, woman is a human being. A bit later, John Stuart Mill ardently defends women. But these philosophers are exceptional in their impartiality. In the 19th century, the feminist quarrel once again becomes a partisan quarrel. One of the consequences of the Industrial Revolution is that women enter the labor force. At that point, women's demands leave the realm of the theoretical and find economic grounds. Their adversaries become all the more aggressive. Even though landed property is partially discredited, the bourgeoisie clings to the old values where family solidity guarantees private property. It insists all the more fiercely that woman's place be in the home as her emancipation becomes a real threat. Even within the working class, men tried to thwart women's liberation because women were becoming dangerous competitors, especially as women were used to working for low salaries. Note, refer to part 2.